distance with blank, globe-like eyes, then resumed following when the human party moved on. Dwyer soon realized there would be no getting rid of them. He'd have to shoot the beasts or ignore them.
"You have other things to keep you busy, son,"
Danel Ozawa ruled. It was an understatement. The clearing near the waterfall still reeked of Urs, Donkey, and Simla when Dwyer warily guided Danel's group across the shallow ford. From then on, he borrowed a tactic from the old wars, reconnoitering each day's march the night before, counting on Urish diurnal habits to keep him safe from ambush, though Urs were adaptable beings. They could be deadly even at night, as human fighters used to find out the hard way. Dwyer hoped this group had lazy habits after generations of peace. Rising at midnight, he would scout by the light of two smaller moons, sniffing warily each time the trail of hoofprints neared some plausible ambuscade. Then at dawn, he would hurry back to help Danel's donkey train plod ahead by day. Ozawa thought it urgent to catch up with the Urish band and negotiate an arrangement, but Dwyer worried. "How does he expect they'll react? Embracing us like brothers? These are criminals, like Reddy's band, like us." The spore grew fresher. Now the Urs were just a week ahead of them, maybe just a few days. He began noting other traces, soft outlines in the sand, broken stone flakes, fragments of a moccasin lace, smudged campfires more than a month old. Reddy's band. The Urs are heading straight for the heart of their territory. Danel took the news calmly.
"They must figure as we did. The human Sooners know a lot about life in these hills. That's valuable experience, whether it can be bought, borrowed, or tortured out of them."
Lena Strong finished, wetting one of her knives by the evening's low red coals.
"Some Urish clans used to keep human prisoners as drudges before we broke them of the habit. A habit they learned from the queens. There's no call to assume slavery is a natural Urs behavior. For that matter, back on old Earth, humans used to..."
"Yeah, well, we still have a problem," Dwyer interrupted. "What to do when we catch up?"
"Right."
Lena inspected the knife edge.
"Do we pounce fast, taking the Urs all bunched together, or do it Hoon style, picking them off one at a time?"
Jennin sighed unhappily.
"Oh, Lena, please stop."
She had been cheerful throughout the journey until hearing all this talk of fighting. Jennin had joined this trek in order to be a founding mother of a new race, not to hunt down beings who had once been her neighbors. Dwyer's heart felt the same pain as Jennin, though his pragmatic side agreed with Lena.
"If we have to, I'd rather do it fast," he muttered, glancing at the donkey carrying their most secret, unspeakable tools. "It shouldn't come to that," Danel insisted. "First, let's ascertain who they are and what they want. Perhaps we can make common cause."
Lena snorted.
"Send an emissary. Give away our presence. You heard, Dwyer. There's over a dozen of them." "Don't you think we should wait for the second group, then?"
Jennin asked.
"They were supposed to be right behind us."
Lena shrugged.
"Who knows how long they'll take? Or if they got lost, the Urs could find us first, and there's the human tribe to consider."
"Reddy's old band?"
"Right. Want to let them get killed or enslaved? Just on account of we're too scared to..." "Lena!" Danel cut her off. "That will do for now. We'll see what's to be done when the time comes. Meanwhile, poor Dwar should get some sleep. We owe him whatever rest he can get."
"That ain't half what he's owed,"
Lena muttered, causing Dwar to glance her way, but in the pre-moonrise dimness he could make out only shadows.
"Good night, all," he said, and slipped away to seek his bedroll.
Mudfoot looked up from the blanket, chuttering testily over having to move. The creature did help warm things up at night, which partly made up for its vexing way of licking Dwar's face while he slept, harvesting perspiration from his forehead and lip. Dwar lay down, turned over, and blinked in surprise at two pairs of giant round eyes, staring back at him from just 3 meters away.
"Cheeky glavers!"
Normally one simply ignored the placid creatures, but he still couldn't shake the memory of that pack of them, clustered greedily around a dead galliter. He tossed a dirt clod vaguely their way.
"Go on, get!"
Just as vaguely, the pair turned and sauntered off. Dwar glanced at Mudfoot.
"Why not make yourself a bit useful and keep those pests away?"
The Noor just grinned back at him. Dwar pulled the blanket over his chin, trying to settle down. He was tired and ached from sore muscles and bruises. But slumber came slowly, freighted with troubling dreams. He woke to a soft touch stroking his face. Irritably, he tried to push the Noor away.
"Quit it, furball! Lick a donkey turd if you want salt so bad."
After a surprised pause, a hushed voice answered.
"Reckon I never been welcome to a man's bed half so sweetly."
Dwar rolled onto an elbow, rubbing one eye to make out a blurred silhouette. A woman.
"Jennin?
Would you prefer her? I won the toss, but I'll fetch her if you like."
"Lena, what can I do for you?"
Dwar made out a white glint, her rare smile.
"Well, you could invite me in from the cold."
Her voice sounded soft, almost shy. Lena was buxom and sanguinely female, yet soft and shy were two words Dwar had never linked with her before.
Sure. Am I still dreaming?"
he wondered as she slid alongside, strong hands working to loosen his clothes. Her smooth skin seemed to blaze with ardent heat.
"I must be. The Lena I know never smelled this good." "You're all knotted up,"
she commented, kneading his neck and back with uncanny, forceful accuracy. At first Dora's gasps came from released muscle strain, but Lena somehow also made each jab or digging twist of her calloused fingers seem feminine, erotic. She got halfway through the massage before Dwar passed his limit of self-control and turned over to gently but resolutely reverse their positions, taking her beneath him, repaying her vitality with a vigor that welled from weeks of pent-up tension. Hoarded worry and fatigue seemed to explode into the air, into the forest, into her, as she clutched and sighed, pulling him closer. After she slipped away, he pondered muzzily.
"Lena thinks I may die, since my job is to be up front in any fight. This may be the only chance."
Dwar drifted into a tranquil, dreamless repose, a slumber so blank and relaxing that he actually felt rested by the time another warm body slid into the bedroll next to him.
By then, his unconscious had worked it out, crediting the women with ultimate pragmatism. "Dan'l will probably be around later, so it makes sense to use whatever I have to give before it's gone." It wasn't his place to judge the women. Theirs was the harder job here in the wilderness. His tasks were simple: to hunt, fight, and, if need be, to die. Theirs was to go on, whatever it took. Dwyer did not even have to rouse all the way, nor did Jennin seem offended that his body performed but half awake. There were all sorts of duties to fulfill these days. If he was going to keep up, he would simply have to catch what rest he could. Dwyer woke to find it already a Midura past midnight. Though he felt much better now, he had to fight a languid lethargy to get dressed and check his gear, the bow and quiver, a compass, sketch pad, and hip canteen, then stop by the dim coals to pluck the leaf-wrap package Jennin left for him each night, the one decent meal he would eat while away. For most of his adult life, he had traveled alone, relishing peace and solitude. Yet he had to admit the attractions of being part of a team, a community. Perhaps under Ozawa's guidance, they might come to feel like family. Would that take some of the bitter sting out of recalling the life and loved ones they had left behind in the graceful forests of the slope? Dwyer was about to head off, following the Urish track farther in the direction of the rising moons, when a soft sound made him pause. Someone was awake and talking, yet he had passed both women, snoring quietly, and, he liked to imagine, happily. Dwyer slipped the bow off his shoulder, moving toward the low speech sounds, more curious than edgy. Soon he recognized the murmured whisper. Of course, it was Dan'l. But who was the sage talking to? Beyond the bole of a large tree, Dwyer peered into a small clearing where satiny moonlight spilled over an unlikely pair. Dan'l was kneeling low to face the little black creature called Mudfoot. Dwyer couldn't make out words, but judging from tone and inflection, Ozawa was trying to ask it questions in one language after another. The newer responded by licking itself, then glancing briefly toward Dwyer, standing in the shadows. When Ozawa switched to Gal 2, Mudfoot grinned, then twisted to bite an itch on one shoulder. When the beast turned back, it was to answer the sage with a gaping yawn. Dan'l let out a soft sigh, as if he had expected to fail, but felt it worth an effort. What effort? Dwyer wondered. Was the sage seeking magical aid, as ignorant lowlanders sometimes tried to do, treating Nur like sprites in some fairy tale? Did Ozawa hope to tame Mudfoot, the way Hoon sailors did, as agile helpers on the river? Few non-Hoon had ever managed that feat. But even if it worked, what use was one Nur assistant? Or would Dwyer's next assignment, after dealing with Urish Sooners and then Reddy's band, be to run back and collect more of Mudfoot's kind? That made no sense. If by some miracle the commons survived, word would be sent calling them all home. If the worst happened, they were to stay as far from the slope as possible. Well, Dan'l will tell me what he wants me to know. I just hope this doesn't mean he's gone crazy. Dwyer crept away and found the Urish trail. He set off at a lope that soon strained forward, pulling him with unwilled eagerness to see what lay beyond the next shadowy rise. For the first time in days, Dwyer felt whole and strong. It wasn't that all worries had vanished. Existence was still a frail, perilous thing, all too easily lost. Still, for this narrow stretch of time, he pounded onward, feeling vibrantly alive.
Ready.
The dream always ended the same way, just before she woke, shivering, clutching a soft blanket to her breast. She dreamed about the bird. Not as it appeared the last time she had seen it, headless, spread across Ron's laboratory bench in the buried station, but as she recalled first glimpsing the strange thing. Vivid in motion, with plumage like glossy forest leaves, alert and lustrous, in a way that seemed to stroke her soul. As a child, she had loved to watch native birds staring for hours at their swooping dives, envying their freedom of the air, their liberty to take wing, leaving their troubles far behind. Then one day, Jas returned from a long journey to the south, bragging about all the beasts he had shot. One had been a fantastic flying thing that they took by surprise as it emerged from a tidal marsh. It barely got away after an arrow tore one wing, flapping off toward the northwest, leaving behind a feather harder than stone. That very night, risking awful punishment, she stole the stiff metal fragment from the tent where the hunters snored, and with a pack of stolen food she ran off, seeking this fabled wonder for herself. As luck had it, she guessed right and crossed its path, spotting the fluttering creature as it labored onward with short, gliding bounds. In a throat-catching instant of recognition, Reddy knew the bird was like her, wounded by the same man's taste for senseless violence. Watching it hop, glide, ever westward, never resting, she knew they shared one more trait, persistence. She wanted to catch up with it, to heal it, talk to it, to learn its source of power, to help it reach its goal, to help find its home. But even disabled, the bird soon outdistanced her. For a heart-aching time, she thought she had lost it forever. At that point of harsh emotion, without transition, the dream shifted to another scene. Suddenly, the bird was right in front of her, closer than ever, fluttering inside a jeweled cage, dodging a mist of golden cloying drops, then cowering away from searing knives of flame. Frustration choked Reddy, unable to give aid, unable to save it. Finally, when all seemed lost, the bird did as Reddy herself would have done. It lashed out with desperate strength, dying to bring down its oppressor, the agent of its torment. For several nights in a row, the dream ended the same way, with someone's insistent arms holding her back in shameful safety, while the bird fired its own head upward toward a hovering, shadowy form, a dark rival with dangling, lethal limbs. It seemed revenge was going to be another of those things that didn't turn out quite the same in real life as she'd imagined. For one thing, in her heart, Reddy never reckoned on Jas taking pain so well. The hunter lay strapped to a couch inside the scout aircraft, his ruggedly handsome features twisting as Kun kept the promise he had made. A promise Reddy regretted a bit more each time Jas clamped back another moan, choking it behind gritted teeth. Who would have thought he'd turn out to be so brave? She pondered, recalling all the times Jas used to brag, bluster, and harass other members of the tribe. Bullies were supposed to be cowards, or so one of the tribe's aged grandfathers used to mutter when he was sure the young hunters wouldn't hear. Too bad the old geep would never know how wrong he'd been. That battered patriarch had died during the months since Reddy left these hills. She tried stealing her heart during the contest of wills between Kun and Jas. One Jas was bound to lose.
"You want to find out where the bird came from, don't you?" she asked herself. "Anyway, don't Jas deserve everything he's getting? Ain't his own stubborn-headedness bringing this on himself?"
Well, in truth, Reddy had played a role in stiffening the hunter's resistance, thus extending his torment. Kun's patient, insistent questions alternated with grunts of pure glaver-like obstinacy from Jas, sweating and contorting under jolts applied by Kun's robot partner. When she could take no more without getting sick, Reddy silently slipped out the hatch. If anything changed, the pilot could call her on the tiny comm button the Sky Humans had installed under the skin near her right ear. She set off toward the campsite, trying to appear casual in case any Sooners watched from the shrubby undergrowth. That was how she thought of them. Sooners. Savages. No different in kind from those puffed-up barbarians on the slope, who thought themselves so civilized with their fancy books, but who were still little more than half-animals, trapped on a dirty world they could never leave. To a sky being like herself, they were all the same, whichever side of the rimmers they led their dirt-scratching lives. She smelled the camp before reaching it, a familiar musty blend of wood-smoke, excrement and poorly tanned hides, all mixed with the sulfury pungence rising from the steam pools that always drew the tribe here this time of year, a fact that made it easy to guide Kun to this pocket canyon, high in the gray hills. Reddy paused halfway to the campsite, smoothing down the sleek jumpsuit Ling had given her, soon after she became the first Jijoan to enter the underground station, that wonderland of luxuries and bright marvels. Ling had also bathed Reddy, treated her scalp, and applied potions and rays to leave her feeling cleaner, stronger, even taller than before. Only the livid scar on one side of her face still marred the mirror's transformed image, and that would be tended, she was assured, when they all went home.
"My home, too," Reddy mused, resuming a brisk pace until all moaning traces of the hunter's torment faded behind her.
She drove out memory of Jas's squirming agony by calling to mind those images the Sky Foursome had shown her, of a splendid, jewel-like city tucked inside a steep-walled valley, a city of fairy towers and floating castles, where one lucky branch of humanity lived with their beloved patrons, the wise, benevolent Rothan. That part didn't quite appeal to her, this business of having masters who told you what to do, nor did the Rothan themselves, when she met the two living aboard the station, who seemed too pretty and prim, too smugly happy by far. But then, if Ling and Besh loved them, she supposed she could get used to that idea, too. Anyway, Reddy was willing to do or put up with anything to reach that city of lights.
"I always knew I belonged someplace else," she thought, rounding a bend in the forest. "Not here, not in a place like this."
Before her stretched a debris-strewn clearing dotted by half a dozen ragged shelters, animal hides thrown over rows of bent saplings, all clustered round a cook fire where soot-smudged figures hunched over a carcass. Tonight's meal, a donkey with a neat hole burned through its heart, a gift courtesy of Kun's handy hunter-killer robot. People dressed in poorly tanned skins moved about at chores or simply slouched through the middle of the day. Their complexions were filthy. Most had matted hair, and they stank. After meeting the Slopies and then Ling and Besh. It was hard to picture these savages as the same race as herself, let alone her own tribe. Several male figures loafed near a makeshift pen where the new prisoners huddled, having barely moved since they were herded into camp a couple of nights back. Some of the men chopped at tree stumps with machetes swiped from the newcomers' supplies, marveling at the keen blades of Buyer metal. But the men kept well away from the pile of crates Kun had forbidden them to touch, awaiting his decision which to destroy. A handful of boys straddled a new fence of laser-split logs, passing the time by spitting, then laughing as angry complaints rose from the captives.
"Shouldn't let him do that," Reddy thought. "Even if the outlanders are nosy fools who oughtn't to have come."
Kun had assigned her the task of finding out what brought the prisoners to these parts, violating their own sacred law. But Reddy felt reluctant, even disgusted. Dawdling, she turned to survey a way of life she once thought she'd never escape. Despite the tumult of the last few days, tribal life went on. Kalish, the old clubfoot, still labored by the stream bed, hammering stone cores into flake arrowheads and other tools, convinced the recent influx of iron implements would be a passing fad. He was probably right. Upstream, women waded through shallows, seeking the tri-shelled juice oysters that ripened in volcanic heat this time of year, while farther upslope, beyond the steamy pools, a cluster of girls used poles to beat Ilois trees, gathering the tart fallen berries in woven baskets. As usual, females were doing most of the hard work. Nowhere was this more evident than near the cook fire, where grouchy old Binny, her arms bloody past the elbows, took charge of preparing the donkey for roasting. The headwoman's hair was even grayer than before. Her latest baby had died, leaving Binny irritable with swollen, tender breasts, hissing at her two young helpers through wide gaps between yellow-brown teeth. Despite such signs of normality, most tribe folk moved in a state of sluggish distraction. Whenever anyone glanced Reddy's way, they flinched, as if she were the last thing on Jijo they ever expected to see. More shocking than a glaiver standing upright. Reddy the god. She held her head high. "Tell your stinky brats about it by the campfire till the end of time. Tell 'em about the girl who talked back to big, mean hunters, no matter what they did to her. A girl who wouldn't take it any more, who dared to do what you never imagined, who found a way to leave this stinking hell and go live on a star." Reddy felt a thrill each time someone briefly met her gaze, and quickly looked away.
"I'm not one of you. Never was. And now you know it, too."
Only Binny showed no trace of being overwhelmed by the deity Reddy had become. The same old disdain and disappointment lay in those metal-gray eyes. At age 28, Binny was younger than any of the forayers, even Ling. Still, it seemed nothing on Jijo or in heaven would ever surprise her. It had been years since Reddy last called the old woman Mama. She wasn't tempted to resume now. With her back straight, she walked past the chefs and their grisly work. Inside, though, she wavered.
"Maybe it wasn't such a good idea to come back here. Why mix with these ghosts when she could be in the aircraft, relishing victory over her lifelong enemy? The punishment being executed on Jas seemed rightful and good, now that she didn't have to face his agony up close. That contradiction made Reddy nervous, as if something were missing, like trying to use moccasins without laces.
"Wife, there you are. Wife, bad wife, to leave ye alone so long."
Several clansmen scurried out of the way, making room for a four-legged creature galloping past their ankles like some untouchable, all-powerful being, which the little Urish male was, in a sense, since Reddy had loudly promised horrors to anyone laying a hand on her husband. Yi leaped into her arms, squirming with pleasure, even as he scolded.
"Wife, leave ye alone too long with female foes. They offer ye soft, warm pouch. Temptresses."
Reddy flared jealousy.
"Who offered you a pouch? If any of those hussies—"
Then she saw he was teasing. Some of the tension in her shoulders let go as she laughed. The little critter was definitely good for her.
"Relax, wife,"
he assured her.
"Just one pouch for ye. Go in now."
"In now,"
she replied, unzipping the plush hip bag Ling had provided. Yi dove inside, wriggled around, then stuck out his head and long neck to peer at her.
"Come now, wife. Visit old Tani. That sage ready talk now."
"Ah, is she? Well now, isn't that awfully nice of her?"
Reddy didn't relish going to see the leader of the Outlanders, but Kun had given her a job, and now was as good a time as any.
"All right," she said. "Let's hear what the hinny has to say."
Dwur. The Urs, it appeared, had done the small human expedition a favor. In receiving death and devastation, they had left a warning. A tale of callous murder was clear to read through the dawn light, in seared and shattered trees, blackened craters, and scattered debris, pushed by a gusty, dry wind. The violence that took place here, just a few days ago by Dwur's estimate, must have been brief, but horrible. The plateau's terraced outlines were still visible after ages of softening by erosion and vegetation. It was a former Buyer site going back to the last race licensed to use this world, legal residents dwelling in heaven-like towers who went through their daily lives unafraid of the open sky. Dwur traced the terror that recently fell upon this place. All too vividly he pictured the panic Urish settlers, rearing and coughing with dread, coiling their long necks, with slim arms crossed to shield their precious pouches as the ground around them exploded. He could almost hear their screams as they fled the burning encampment, down a steep trail leading into a narrow defile, where human footprints swarmed in abruptly from both sides, tracked by crude moccasins, mingling with Urish hooves chaotically. He picked up shreds of home-twisted twine and leather cord. From countless signs, Dwur pictured ropes and nets falling to trap the Urs, taking them prisoner. Couldn't they tell they were being herded? The aircraft aimed off to the sides and all around to drive them. So why didn't the Urs scatter instead of clumping in a mass to be caught? Several patches of sticky sand gave him an answer. The overall intent might have been capture, but the flying gunner had few qualms about enforcing the roundup with a corpse or two. "Don't judge the Urs too harshly. Do you know how you'll react when lightning bolts start falling all around? War is messy, and we're all out of practice. Even Drake never had to cope with anything like this." "So we're facing an alliance between the human Sooners and the aliens," Lena concluded. "Kind of changes things, don't it?" Danilo Ozawa wore a bleak expression.
This entire region is compromised. Whatever fate befalls the slope will now surely happen here as well. Whether by plague or by fire or hunting their victims one at a time with machines, they'll scourge the area as thoroughly as back home.
Danil's task had been to carry a legacy into the wilderness, both knowledge and fresh genes to invigorate the human tribe already living here, to preserve something of earthling life in case the worst came to pass. It was never a joyous enterprise, more like a mission of a lifeboat captain in some ancient tale about a shipwreck. But at least that endeavor had been based on a slim hope. Now, his eyes lacked all trace of that emotion.
Jennin protested. "Well, didn't you just say the Sooners and aliens were allies against the Urs? The Star Gods wouldn't turn on the tribe now, would they?"
She stopped as the others looked at her, their expressions answering better than words. Jennin paled.
"Oh."
Moments later, she lifted her chin once more.
"Well, they still don't know we exist, right? So why don't we just leave, right now, the four of us? What about north, Dwer? You've been up that way before. Let's go."
Danil kicked some debris left by the Ur's riotous flight and the looting that followed. He pointed to a narrow cleft in the rocks.
"We can build a pyre over there."
"What are you doing?"
Jennin asked, as Dwer led the donkeys where the sage indicated and began unloading their packs.
"I'll set the grenades,"
Lena said, prying open a container.
"We'd best add some wood. I'll gather these broken crates." "Hey, I asked you guys what's going on."
Danil took Jennin's arm while Dwer hauled a portion of their supplies to one side. Food and clothing, plus a few basic implements, nothing containing any metal. Left behind in a stack were all the books and sophisticated tools they had taken from the slope. The sage explained.
"We brought this legacy in order to maintain some minimal semblance of human culture in exile. But four people can't establish a civilization, no matter how many books they have. We must prepare for the likelihood that all of this must be destroyed."
Clearly the prospect gnawed at Ozawa. His face, already haggard, now seemed sliced by pain. Dwer averted his gaze, concentrating on the work at hand, separating only supplies helpful to a small party of fugitives on the run. Jennin chewed on the news and nodded.
"Well, if we must live and raise families without books, I guess that just puts us ahead of schedule, no? A bit farther along the path of—"
She stopped. Danil was shaking his head.
"No, Jennin, that is not the way things will be. Oh, we four might as well try to survive, but even if we did make it to some far-off valley, beyond reach of whatever demise the aliens have planned, it's unlikely we'd adapt to a strange ecosystem in time. Reddy told us that her band lost half its first generation to accidents and allergic reactions. That's typical for Sooner groups, till they learn what's safe to eat or touch. It's a deadly trial-and-error process. Four just isn't enough."
"I thought—"
"And that leaves out the problem of inbreeding."
"You can't mean—"
"But even if we could solve all of those dilemmas, it still wouldn't work, because we aren't going to start a band of fallen savages spiraling into ignorance, even if the Skrulls give that fate all sorts of fancy names. Human beings never came to Jijo for the path of redemption."
Dwer looked up from his work. Lena halted as well, holding a thick tube with a clockwork fuse at one end. Up to that point, Ozawa had been explaining what Dwer already knew,
But now, silence reigned. No one was going to move or speak until the sage explained. For a second time, Danil Ozawa sighed deeply.
The secret is passed on to a few, each generation. But I see no point in concealing it from you three, whom I now think of as kin, as family. Some of the other five races were appalled when we built Byblos. The great printing seemed to imply we had no intention of ever forgetting. Our founders did some smooth talking to explain the flood of books. A temporary measure, they called it. A way to help all races live in enough comfort to concentrate on developing their souls till we're spiritually ready to move on down the path. Officially, it's the long-term goal of each of the six. But the Tabernacle founders never meant their descendants to devolve down to speechless proto-humans, ready for some race of star gods to adopt and uplift.
The sage paused until Dwerp finally broke in.
Then why are we here?
Danil shrugged.
Everyone knows that each race had ulterior motives. Those forbidden to breed at home sought a place where they can have offspring as they please. Or take the Gekex, who tell of persecutors hounding them throughout the Starlands.
So humans came to Jijo because folks on Earth weren't sure they'd survive?
Ozawa nodded.
Oh, we'd made a few friends who helped Earth get a library branch, and having uplifted two client races, we won low-level patron status. Still, galactic history doesn't offer much hope for a wolfling race like ours. We already had enemies. The Terrigan's Council knew Earth would be vulnerable for a long time to come.
So the Tabernacle crew weren't outcasts?
Danil ticked a thin smile.
A cover story, in case the colonists were caught, so the Council could disavow them as renegades. In fact, our ancestors were sent to find a hidden refuge for humankind.
The sage raised his hands.
But where? Despite rumors, no route is known beyond the five galaxies. Within them, every star is cataloged, many with leaseholders to watch over them. So the Terrigan searched the Great Library to see what other races did in our position. Despite flaws, the sooner phenomenon showed promise.
Lena shook her head. There's a lot you're leaving out. Like, what are we supposed to be doing here while hiding if our mission isn't to go down the path?
If Lester or the others know, they haven't told me,
Danil answered.
Maybe we're to sit tight and wait for the universe to change. Anyway, that hardly matters now. If our culture's finished, I won't have any part in going on as wretched fragments, whelping kids who will be no more than savage brutes.
Jennin started to speak, but then pressed her lips. At least we know Earth has survived a few hundred years, Dwer said. Though the Forayers say there's a crisis,
Lena noted,
with Earth in the middle of it.
Danil looked away, his jaw set.
Hey, Dwer said, aren't the Sky Humans exactly what the Terra Council wanted? To have a branch of humans off somewhere safe from whatever happens to Earth? Those guys you met back at the Glade have these Rothan characters to protect them.
Danil exhaled.
Perhaps, though, who knows if they'll remain human under that influence.
and the irony of being murdered by cousins seems too much to bear." The sage shook himself as if shedding cobwebs. "Let's prepare that pyre. If these items cannot serve a civilized tribe of exiled earthlings, then we can at least do our duty by this world and leave no dross. Lena, set the timer to go off one day from now, if we don't return."
"Return?" Lena looked up from her preparations. "I thought we were giving up."
She rocked back as the sage whirled with some of the old fire in his eyes.
"Who said anything about giving up? What's the matter with you three? Look at your faces. Are you going to let one little setback get you down?"
"A little setback?" Dwyer wondered, glancing at the blast scars and shattered trees surrounding the Urish encampment.
"I don't get it. You said we can't finish our mission."
"So?" Danil Ozawa demanded. "We're adaptable. We'll switch missions. We're not colonists anymore. So what? We can still be warriors."
Ready.
The prisoners lay dejected in muddy wallows, necks drooping, already stinking after 2 days' confinement in the dank pen. 13 Urs, who would have preferred the arid plateau where they had settled, till a warcraft screeched over their camp without warning, casting lightning, driving the survivors toward Jass and the other hunters, waiting with rough ropes. Thus Kun had fulfilled his side of a bargain, ridding the hills of a recent hated Urish infestation. In return, Jass was to guide Kun to the site where he and Baum first saw the flying bird thing. No one knew why the deal later broke down, why Jass abruptly changed his mind, preferring the robot's caresses over giving the pilot what he wanted. No one except Reddy.
"Binny used to say, 'Why defy men who can beat you if you make them mad? Use words to nudge and guide the brutes. Make them think it was their idea all along.' But I kept talking back, didn't I? Well, I finally tried it your way, Binny, and know what? You were right. Nothing I could do to Jass could ever hurt him like he's hurting himself right now."
Baum was guarding the gate to the prisoner's pen. The burly hunter hurriedly obeyed her command to open up, not once meeting Reddy's eyes. He knew where his pal was now. Just two things kept Baum from sharing the same fate. First was his notoriously poor sense of direction. Alone, he could never find the place where he and Jass had spotted the metal bird. The other thing was Reddy's whim. Baum's abject cringing pleased her more than screams. This bully was scared half out of his breech clout. When she glared at the boys spitting at the prisoners, they jumped off the wall and ran. She cast curt laughter after them. The tribe kids never used to speak to her in the old days either. She entered the pen. Ultani, leader of the unlucky Urs, greeted Reddy with a fluid bow of her long neck. From a gray-fringed snout, she launched into a series of whistles and clicks till Reddy broke in.
"None of that now," she admonished. "I don't follow that jabber."
Wincing, Ultani switched to Anglic.
"I apologize. Your attire deceives the eye into seeing a galactic-level entity."
Reddy lifted her head.
"You weren't deceived. That's exactly what I am. I hope,"
she added and sighed. Ron and the others could change their minds before the ship returned, especially once she gave them all she had in trade. Even if the forayers kept their word, she would, in time, have to learn all those crazy languages they used among the stars.
"Again, regret for having offended. Is it true, then, you have been adopted off Jizo's forlorn desert into the running clan of star creatures? What a fortunate youngling you are."
"Yeah," Reddy agreed, wondering if the Urz was being sarcastic. "So Yi says you're ready to tell us what your bunch was doing out here beyond the Rimmers?"
A long sigh blew the gray fringe.
"We arrived disgracefully to set off a colony free-serving our kind in a secret sanctuary."
Reddy grunted.
"That much is obvious, but why here? Why now?"
"It is a site already ascertained to be habitable, suitable for sustaining earthlings, and therefore the donkeys we rely on. You yourself testified to that fact."
"Ah."
Altani must have been one of the junior sages in the pavilion when Reddy told her story to the High Council.
"Go on."
"As to our haste, we sought to elude the fate soon to fall on the sloth. Annihilation at the hands of the star felons."
Reddy reacted angrily.
"I've heard that damn lie before. They never do a thing like that."
Altani rocked her head.
"I stand corrected. Clearly such fine entities would not slay folk who had done them no hurt, nor cast death without warning from a cloudy sky."
This time, the sarcasm was thick. Reddy glanced at a young middling Urz with a nasty burn along one flank from the flying robot's heat beam.
"Well, I guess it's just your tough luck we had reason to come visit, asking directions, and found you already at war with my old family."
"Not war, a transient discord, one we did not initiate. Naturally, your cousins were shocked to see us. Our idea was to vanquish their reflex hostility with resolute friendliness, to induce cordiality with gifts and offers of assistance."
"Yeah, right."
Reddy knew how early human settlers had been treated by Urish clans of yore.
"I bet you also counted on having better weapons than any they had here."
Again, a snorted sigh.
"As your associates crushed us, using power far greater than our own, it kindles wonder. Could this chain of uneven strength be extrapolated?"
Reddy didn't like the bemused look in those beady, Urish eyes.
"What do you mean?"
"A conjecture. Could there exist forces as far superior to your new lords as they are over us? In all the wide galaxies, can one ever be sure one has chosen the right side?"
The words sent twinges up Reddy's spine, reminding her of recent disturbing dreams.
You don't know nothing about galaxies and such, so don't you pretend.
At that moment, a sudden yelp cut her short as Yi popped his head out of the pouch, mewling with unease. A ripple of reaction spread among the prisoners' husbands, who emerged howling, swinging their heads to face south. Soon the larger females followed suit, clambering to their feet. Reddy worried. Was it a revolt? But no, clearly something was unnerving them.
"What do you hear?"
she demanded of Yi.
"Engine!"
the little Urs answered, corkscrewing his agile neck. A moment later Reddy sensed it too, a distant whine. She brought a hand to the bump near her ear and pressed.
"Hey, Kun, what's going on?"
There followed a long pause, during which the open line relayed cabin sounds, switches being thrown, motors revving. Finally, the pilot's voice buzzed near her skull.
"Jas chose to cooperate, so we're off now in search of the source of your metal bird."
"But I want to go, too."
Kun's reply was cool.
"Jas told me everything, including the reason he resisted so hard. It seems you convinced him I'd finish him off the moment he told what he knew, that he would live only until then. Now why did you tell the poor bastard such a thing, Reddy? It caused inconvenience and unnecessary pain."
Reddy thought,
"Unnecessary for you, but darn important to me."
Revenge was only half of her rationale for manipulating Jas, but it would have been enough all by itself.
"Kun, don't leave me. I'm one of you now. Ron and Besh and even Ropol said so."
Suddenly she felt small and very vulnerable, with Urs in front of her and Bomb behind at the gate, surrounded by others who would surely love to bring her down. She covered her mouth and lowered her voice, whispering urgently for the little transmitter.
"The Sooners'll turn on me, Kun. I know it."
"Perhaps you should have thought of that before."
Another long pause followed. Then,
"If Ron hadn't insisted on long-range radio silence, I could talk it over with the others before deciding."
"Deciding what?"
"Whether to bring you back or to leave you where you began."
Reddy fought down a trembling that coursed her body in response to Kern's harsh words. Her hopes were a bright tower that seemed about to crash.
"I'll tell you what. I'll leave the robot to protect you, Reddy. It will do what you say till I get back. Do not abuse the privilege."
Her heart leaped at the phrase, "till I get back."
"I promise,"
she whispered urgently.
"Treat this as a second chance. Question the Urs. Destroy their weapons. Don't let anyone leave the valley. Do a good job, and we may wipe the slate clean when I return, providing my hunt flushes out the prey at last."
"Kun out."
The line clicked, cutting off the cabin sounds. Reddy quelled an urge to press the button and choke out another plea to be taken along. Instead, she set her teeth grimly and climbed the fence rails to stare as a silvery dart lifted out of the narrow canyon, turned in the morning light, then streaked southward, leaving her with a heart as cold and barren as a glacier.
Dwer. The Sooner village was a simmering place that squatted at the base of a canyon filled with dense, sulphurous, listless air. A hellish place, from an Urish point of view. Dwer's high vantage point looked down at the captives in their cramped pen. Long necks drooped, and they lay, like the atmosphere, barely moving.
"I count about a dozen, not including dead ones, just as you said," Lena noted,
peering through her compact telescope. "I guess you'll do as a tracker, Fellamy boy." "Thanks, O mistress of forbidden devices," Dwyer answered. He was getting used to Lena's ways. She always had to get a little bite in, even when making a compliment. It was like a Noor purring in your lap who repays your petting by dipping its claws briefly into your thigh. The funny thing was, he'd actually been getting used to the idea of making a life with this woman, along with Jennin, Danil, and the lost tribe of human exiles. Even discovering the Urish invasion hadn't made the notion absurd. Danil had been right. There might have been room for common cause. But now, all such ideas were obsolete. Over to the left lay the reason why. A silver-gray machine, shaped like a Hoonish cigar with stubby wings. It was the first alien thing Dwyer had seen, since almost being killed with Reddy by a floating robot that evening in a Mulk spider's lair. The sky car should not be here in the Badlands. It meant the demolishment of all their plans. It also had no business being so beautiful. Dwyer was proud of this overlook, high on the canyon wall, which surveyed from the village, past the steam pools, all the way to the flying machine, sitting in a nest of crushed vegetation. "I wish the yokels would stop moving around. It's hard getting a good count," Lena complained. "At least the kid said the local bully boys won't let women use weapons, so they aren't combatants to worry about." She sniffed disdain over such a stupid waste of resources. Dwyer would prefer not to fight Jijoan humans as well as the alien kind. Anyway, their only real chance lay in achieving complete surprise. Sharing the cramped ledge, Dwyer felt Lena's breast pressing against his arm, yet it provoked no arousal. Their bodies seemed to grasp that a change had occurred. There would be no more passionate episodes, no life-affirming gestures. Sex and gender were important to colonists planning to raise families, not to a raiding party bent on destruction. All that mattered now were skills and an ability to count on one another.
"It looks like a standard atmospheric scout," Danil Ozawa said. "Definitely a fighter. I wish we brought along just one text on galactic technology. Give me the glass, will you?"
Like Dwyer's and Lena's, Danil's face now bore jagged charcoal slashes that were supposed to muddle the pattern-recognizing optics of alien killer machines. Dwyer preferred thinking of it as war paint.
"Well, I'll be," Danil muttered. "Here, take a look. I guess now we know how the star gods found this place."
When Dwyer got the telescope, the first thing he noticed was that the flyer's hatch now lay ajar, revealing part of the interior, including banks of control panels.
"If only we were close right now," he thought, "with the door open and no guard robot in sight."
"Look to the right, up the trail a ways," Danil urged. Dwyer shifted the spyglass, sweeping till he glimpsed a small figure dressed in one of the aliens' one-piece garments, moving toward the Sooner encampment.
"Great Ifni's egg!" he yelped.
"What is it?" Lena demanded, grabbing the scope as Dwyer rolled on his back, staring past tangled branches at a murky sky.
"Well, well," Lena muttered. "Looks like she caught up with us after all."
"I should have strangled her when she stole my bow. I should have left her to the damn spider."
"You don't mean that, son," Danil chided.
Dwyer knew the sage was right. Still, he grumbled.
Oh, don't I? She was a pain from the start. Now she's ruined everything. Perhaps Reddy was coerced.
But the sage sounded unconvinced as they took turns with the telescope. Each of them had seen the girl's clothes, her freshly coiffed hair, and her confident stride, swaggering into camp like she owned the place.
"She's gone to see the prisoners," Lena reported a little later. "Talking to one of them now. Those Urs sure look ragged, poor things."
Lena tisked, and her sympathy was clearly more than sarcastic.
"I wish I could make out."
She stopped as Dwar suddenly gripped her arm, reacting to a faint, high keening that seemed to scrape the inside of his skull. The newer beast chuttered irritably, shaking its head and sneezing. Soon the noise deepened and grew loud enough for the rest of them to hear. Even Jenin, who was on lookout duty upslope, hissed a worried query. The clamor came from the aircraft. It made Dwar's teeth feel as if they were loosening in their moorings.
"Something's coming out," Lena exclaimed, turning the telescope. "It's the robot."
Dwar saw a hovering black dot with dangling tendrils separate from the ship, whose hatch then closed. The air shimmered from expelled dust as humming motors lifted the scout off the ground. The gray arrowhead was larger than the house Dwar grew up in, yet it wafted upward and turned lightly, stopping when its nose pointed almost due south. Then the heavens echoed its fierce growl as it plunged away, receding faster than anything he had ever seen.
"Damn," Danil cursed. "We missed our best opportunity."
Lena wasn't watching the departing scout. Instead, her eyes followed the black robot, now cruising toward the tribal village.
"Don't worry," she assured. "I expect we'll get another chance."
The Glavers were back. Of all irksome times for the stupid things to tag along. They must have followed at their own lazy pace all the way from last night's campsite. Now they mewled unhappily at the sights and smells of the fetid ravine, but that did not keep them from following Dwar as he left the shelter of the forest, heading toward the cluster of rude huts. Dwar glanced back at Lena Strong, crouched at the edge of the last line of trees. With raised eyebrows, she asked if he wanted her to shoot the idiotic beasts. He said no, with a terse headshake. They were dangerous only to a man who was trying to hide, and he did not mind being conspicuous at this point. In fact, that was the general idea. Still, when he passed a rotting log, he gave it several swift kicks, exposing a rich trove of grubs swarming the interior. The distracted Glavers crooned delight and dove in for the kill, which left just one irritation. The scampering newer beast, who darted through the meadow grass and between his legs. Trying to ignore Mudfoot and carrying his bow slung over one shoulder, Dwar walked with feigned nonchalance past a devastation of jagged tree stumps toward the bustling Sooner tribe. The prisoner's pen lay a quarter of an arrow flight to the left, the huts to the right. Straight ahead, a cook fire fumed smoke that hovered lazily as if reluctant to depart.
"Come on, people,"
Dwar mused when he was over halfway across the pocket meadow and still unnoticed. "Don't you have any sort of sentry system?" He pursed his lips and whistled a tune. "Yankee Doodle," the first thing to come to mind. Finally, one of the kids peering at the Urish captives glanced his way, did a gaping double-take, and began screaming, pointing at Dwar. Well, whatever works. Their reaction might have been different as recently as a week ago. For generations, these people had seen no outsiders at all. Now, after making contact with an Urish band, then flying aliens, and the lost cousin transformed into a goddess, they took his arrival pretty well. Only 3 out of 4 ran away, howling in terror. Hesitantly, with goggle eyes that showed white around the rims, the remainder gathered to stare at him, edging forward in a clump when he showed no sign of aggression.